The mic works. Hold on a minute. I got to talk to the class for a minute. Okay. Okay. Today, we're going to have a guest lecture from Trevor Fraser, one of our TAs, and he'll be talking about Minjung theology in Korean Christianity. Okay, this is Trevor Fraser.
Okay. Can everyone hear me? A little more loud? Okay. Thank you, Dr. Hori. So, I'm going to tell you about Minjung Christianity today. And I should start by apologizing because I'm not any sort of expert on Minjung theology. I've just done a lot of research recently about it, so I'm sharing this with you guys. But I would love to hear afterwards if anyone knows more about it. You can come up and talk to me. So first, I'll tell you a little bit about what Minjung means. So Minjung is not a school or a sect, the way that Zen is a school of Buddhism or Protestant or Presbyterianism is a denomination of Christianity. Minjung thought is like more of a characteristic of Korean Christianity as it developed in Catholic and Protestant churches throughout Korea. So you can't find a Minjung church, but you can find Minjung thinkers, and you can find the theology reflected in churches across Korea. Minjung, in Chinese, the literal characters are people mass. So what we're talking about is the people in a socialist sense or a populist sense, and it actually comes from communist uses of the word Minjung. but Minjung thinkers also find a term in the Bible which they use to describe the Minjung. This term is the oklos. And I don't speak Greek, ancient Greek, so that could be wrong, but I think it's oklos. This is usually translated as the multitudes. So it is a term that appears frequently in Mark, and it refers to the throngs of common people that would gather around Jesus while he was preaching. Mark claims that these people are the favored of God's kingdom, as opposed to the more elite people which Jesus was addressing, but which never actually appear in the Bible. Or the oklos don't appear as individuals. They just appear as a mass of people, a multitude. So in Minjung theology, it is highlighted that these people were also society's unwanted. So not only are they non-elite, but they're considered to be bad people. They're the tax collectors, the peasants, the sex workers or prostitutes. Minjung points out that these people are normally thought to be the worst of sinners. But in Christianity, and this is emphasized in Minjung, it is these people that Jesus chose for salvation. This is just a picture of a Korean sex worker at work. So before I move on, I'll try to give a little bit of context, the historical background. So in many ways, Minjung theology begins with the tactics of Protestant missionaries in the early 20th century. Unlike the Catholics, they decided to focus on people most in need of support, like material support. So they provided education in the Korean indigenous language, and they provided hospitals, and they would target people who needed long-term care for their hospital so that they could evangelize to them more effectively. The Protestants targeted workers and peasants. Women were also important because mothers are the ones who raise the next generation. So women, workers, peasants were the targets of their evangelism. And it so happened that Korea's northern provinces are the most resource-rich, and thus they're more populated by workers and peasants. The problem with this is that the communists were also targeting workers, peasants, and women in the resource-rich north. So when with the outbreak of the Korean War, the communists took advantage to undermine Korean Christianity by purging Christians. So there was widespread suppression in the communist liberated North. Millions of Christians had to flee to South Korea. And with the ceasefire, these Christians became permanent refugees in the South. So what happened was that at war's end, we had millions of people without a home. They were now refugees in their own country, but not their own home, villages or anything. So all these people were looking for a way to get regrounded and to rebuild their culture. That's the way that scholars understand this. And this is just a picture of communists, Northern Korea communist women, to show that they were also being targeted. So unfortunately for all of these Christian refugees in the South, South Korea was soon to become a military dictatorship. With the U.S. occupation, there were anti-communist policies, and the government became increasingly restrictive as it became more and more paranoid about a communist invasion. And this anti-communist rhetoric was very similar to the anti-terrorist rhetoric that we see now, in that it can just be applied to any group that the government wants to suppress. And this included student protesters throughout the 1960s, or throughout the 1950s, sorry. In 1960, this came to a culmination where there was a massive student uprising and the government ended up slaughtering a lot of students. The president fled the country and a military dictatorship took power. The president, Park Chung-hee, who is pictured here, was in power throughout the 1960s and 1970s. So he's a very important person in the Minjung history. He ruled with an iron fist and single-minded direction. Under his watch, South Korea underwent one of the world's fastest industrializations. This involved instituting bureaucracies and international corporations, all of which the Minjung feel are cold and not for their needs, and they don't have their interests in mind. Park also kept very close ties to the U.S., economically and militarily, and to Japan. And this ended up keeping an iron wall between South and North Korea, which is something that Minjung thinkers will come back to as well. So in the 1960s and 70s, the Korean Christians gradually came to realize that it needed to stand up to the dictator. Christian organizations began to be involved in unionizing in exploitative industries. And in 1973, a secret document circulated called the Theological Declaration of Korean Christians. It called for martyrdom and for Christians to make political witness their top priority, calling it the key to God's kingdom. In fact, many church leaders, all the way up to bishops in the Catholic Church and the equivalent in the Protestant churches, were arrested for sedition and imprisoned under cruel conditions. And pictured here we have, these are both Seoul. This is Seoul in the early 1960s, and this is Seoul at the end of the Minjung movement in the early 1990s. You can see how it transformed from basically wooded farmland to a busy metropolis. But there's still protesters. Yeah. So Christians joined students in the street for massive demonstrations, holding signs like, "Resurrection of democracy is liberation of the people." There were also more uniquely Christian forms of protest. There were prayer meetings to educate about the government. So you would go to a prayer meeting and you would pray, but also you would have guests who were like people who had been in prison, and then they would share their experience of being tortured with the people in the prayer circle. There were special masses to commemorate people who had been arrested. There were political messages during the sermons. So during a sermon, the priest would tell you to go and protest, or that the president was a dictator and that it should be overthrown. And in rare cases, there would be forms of martyrdom. There's a famous incident of in 1970, a worker set himself on fire. And this is considered to be, the self-immolation is considered to be the spark that started, for real, in earnest, the Minjung movement. Sorry, that was really bad.
It was a great
part. No. So how can these rituals and this political focus be reconciled with the Christian faith? Throughout the 1970s and 1980s, Christians began to think about and theologize about their participation in this resistance. They developed what they called Minjung theology. As scholars, we can see how it addresses social justice history, as well as drawing on traditional Korean religions while retaining a Christian core. One way that, as scholars, we can think about this is that Minjung theology is a this-worldly religion. So arrested Christians were generally charged under the anti-communist laws, which means that the state saw such actors as engaged in political acts. But the Christians maintained that their actions were religious. Here's an example. It says, we are under God's command that we should be faithful to his word in concrete historical situations. So the Minjung theologians don't see a difference between political activity and religious activity. This comes from the 1973 Declaration of Korean Christians, and it establishes that Christians are called to respond to society's injustices, that salvation is not something waiting in the afterlife, but that Christians must realize their salvation in this world. I'm sure you've noticed this immanent quality in other religions that we've studied so far in the semester, such as Zen Buddhism or Confucianism or the impact of ancestor ritual. I'm not going to go into that, but I'm sure you guys realize this. I'm going to talk about two concepts that Minjung theologians reinterpret. One is the Messiah, and the other is the millennium. So the central symbol for Christianity is the cross, because it points to the event that holds the fundamental meaning for Christians, which is Jesus's crucifixion. The basic idea is that Jesus suffered and died on the cross, and that he actually did die. He was dead for 3 days, and he lay in a tomb. But on the third day, he was resurrected and came back to the world. Then after another period, he ascended to heaven, and he's now reunited with God. His death and resurrection are proof of God's power to overcome evil. And the crucifixion is also often described as a sacrifice, God sacrificing his son, and also Jesus sacrificing himself for God and for humanity. So in Minjung theology, this idea is extended and elaborated. So it incorporates more of the historical context and social consciousness of Jesus' time. The crucifixion's meaning becomes associated with political rebellion. Jesus is seen as a rebel figure who is standing up for the oklos, or the common people, or just the marginalized in general. And for this reason, he comes into conflict with the oppressive elites, the Roman Empire, and elements of his own Jewish society. So his arrest, torture, and execution are therefore seen by Minjung thinkers as inevitable outcome of standing up against injustice. And this is certainly what their own experience would lead them to believe. But unlike their own experience, in Jesus' case, he overcomes death. He overcomes his oppressors. For this reason, the crucifixion is a source of inspiration and the proof of ultimate justice. In the retelling of this gospel, Jesus is seen to be one with the Minjung. he does not only stand up for the Minjung, but he shares in their suffering. His role is what some Minjung thinkers would call a suffering servant. The Messiah emerges from the suffering people and identifies with the suffering people. Now, the experience of many Korean thinkers would lead them to be wary of messianic figures, given their experience with North Korean communism and the figure of Kim Il-sung, who is on the other side there. They describe such figures as power messiahs because they emerge out of the masses, but do not continue to share in the masses' experience. Instead, they become a new elite. And Minjung thinkers even find in the Old Testament stories of how power corrupts very good leaders. So even King David, King Solomon, and Ahab, for Minjung thinkers, they're all despotic monarchs, despite being respectable figures in mainstream Christianity. The only ideal monarch is a servant king under the sovereign will of the people. The sovereign will of the people. So, oh, this is a bit of an aside, but there are other messiah figures in Korean culture, such as brave Hong Kildong, who is the Korean Robin Hood. If anyone wants to ask me about him, I can tell you more later, afterwards. So when I say the sovereign will of the people, you should probably think about the mandate of heaven. The mandate of heaven is the basis of Korean history telling from the beginning of written history in Korea to the end of the Joseon dynasty, due to the influence of Confucianism. But as Korean nationalism begins to find a voice, the mandate of heaven is rejected as being a Chinese import that doesn't necessarily accord to Korean social reality. The Silhak, I think Dr. Hoi mentioned this before, the Silhak are the practical learning school in the 19th century. They were the first to bring this up. They first raised this question about whether the mandate of heaven applied to Korea. And in Minjung theology, we see that they're taking up this question and saying that heaven is no longer the source of authority. It's the people that are the definitive source of authority in Korean society. Minjung thinkers express this by saying, the Minjung are the true subjects of history. There's a common saying in the West that history is told by the winners. This is true, but it's more important to think about the fact that history is only told from the point of view of the elites, whether they're winners or losers. They're all elites. So throughout history, we see that peasant uprisings are described as disasters. Sex workers are described as immoral and impoverished. Workers are filthy and uncivilized. And so on. The lower classes are never given a voice in history that is fair to their perspective. So when we say that the Minjung are the true subjects of history, we're not talking about the history which has already been written. What we are saying is that the Minjung are the sources of authority. They are the ones that we should be asking, was your uprising just or unjust? Is your sex work immoral or fulfilling? Is your job filthy or simply hard work? In essence, Minjung thinkers are reinterpreting the mandate of heaven. If the government responds and respects the needs of the Minjung, then it is a good government. But if it is oppressive to the Minjung, then it has ceded its mandate. This gives license to the Minjung to rebel and form a new government. Minjung Christians, of course, believe that God is the ultimate authority, but because Jesus is one with the Minjung are still considered to be the only legitimate source. So I return to the original point of the section, which is that Minjung is about engaging with the social oppressions of today, that is a this-worldly religion. In doing so, Christians are building a better society for all. In fact, they are reinterpreting the meaning of the Christian term millennium. Minjung thinkers understand themselves to be building a perfect society, which is often called a New Jerusalem, right in Korea. This is not the interpretation of millennium that the Western missionaries would have brought to Korea. Millennium is a term from the Book of Revelations, It refers to a thousand-year period of perfect peace and prosperity following the second coming of Christ. In the 19th century, Protestants generally took this doctrine literally. They saw the chaos of European warfare and nationalism as a downward spiraling mess that could only be ended by the coming of Christ, a radical change to the social reality. So for Christian missionaries, the millennium was imminent. It was going to be very soon, but it would also completely cut off their era of history from the next. So this scholars would interpret this as being a very individualistic view of millennium, because it feeds off the individual's disgust and rejection for current society and gives them the hope that effortlessly their dream of a new society will be fulfilled in the near future. So for Koreans, this puts too much emphasis on the individual, not enough on the community. According to Haesung Park, in the kingdom of God, the salvation of the individual person is secured, but in the millennium is secured the salvation of the whole social reality of humankind. We see here the idea that salvation is communal, and it comes about through the establishment of a just community in this world and this time. Despite the chaos and injustice of authoritarian rule, the Minjung believed that society could be reformed and perfected through Christian action. If we think back to the first learning cell, many of us discussed how in East Asian society, the individual's freedom results from harmonizing with existing society. By contrast, the Western individual changes society to fit their own happiness. I think everyone remembers that. In Minjung theology, we see that society must be reconfigured so as to harmonize with the well-being of all people. So this retains the idea that individual happiness depends on society, but it also allows for social change, so long as that social change is community-led and determining the social change. This is an example of a view of this millennium. Haesung Park says, in Korea, the millennium means an egalitarian society free from patriarchy and hierarchy, a self-determining country beyond foreign intervention, a reunified country beyond the division between North and South, and a democratic society beyond northern totalitarianism and southern authoritarianism. This is a state where everyone seeks to promote community actualization beyond self-centered actualization. Here, an individual actualizes his or her potentials through helping others to actualize their potentials. So the idea that salvation is communal is given a theological basis by Minjung thinkers. Their justification hints at Taoist and Buddhist concepts along the way, further rooting this in the East Asian context, though I haven't totally thought through this very thoroughly. But I can give you the basic beginnings. It begins with the conception of God, as articulated by Anselm Min. God the Father is the eternal source of all divinity and existence. And in an emptying gesture, he shares the totality of his divinity with the other, which is often called Christ the Son or all of creation. The other reciprocates the love of the Father by returning, emptying all of its being to him. This emptying movement is called love or the Holy Spirit. So this idea has a certain similarity to the conception of the Tao. As you may remember, the Tao is described as eternal and immutable, transcendent, yet in a constant outpouring out of nothingness springs all the 10,000 things, all of what in the West we call creation. And the 10,000 things inevitably return to the nothingness from whence they sprang. This is the movement of the Tao. In both, there's the cycle of reciprocity between immanent and metaphysical reality. And salvation comes from according with the natural movement of reciprocity, which in Christianity is called love. Anselm Min further describes all of existence as created by God to be interdependent. The illusion of self-sufficiency in such a world necessarily entails exploitation, domination, and suffering. In recognizing our interdependence, through solidarity and love, we can find the way to God. And the basic ideas here about interdependence and suffering are similar to those in Buddhism, you also might know. But importantly, there is no idea of no self, which is really the core to Buddhism, and so I would hesitate to say that this is Buddhist. Sorry. Finally, because salvation comes from the reciprocal movement between God and the other is interdependent, we can consider the whole world to be the other. For that reason, salvation can only take place through the concrete historically given community of interdependence. For the Minjung, this community is the nation of Korea. So I feel like that was a little confusing, but I'm just trying to show the theological basis for saying that Christians should be engaging in their own community politically.
Sorry, who are those two?
Oh yeah, sorry, this is a very interesting image. On the left, you can see this person has a cross, which would indicate that it's Jesus. And the caption to the photo said that this is God on the right, which would be extremely unorthodox to have an image of God. But nevertheless, I felt this really shows up how the movement between God and the Son is what is supposed to create our existence on earth. So it is a very interesting image, even if it's wrong. I mean, even if the interpretation is wrong. So I'm going to go a little bit into the rituals and practices to try and give you a better sense for what Minjung Christianity feels like on the ground. So to start with, we're going to talk about Han. Han comes from the Korean shamanistic tradition. And Minjung theology actually places a strong emphasis on Han. And Minjung theology has a lot of commonalities with shamanism, and they actually value shamanism a lot. Han is a way to talk about good and evil and the individual's role in this moral struggle while retaining the idea of communal salvation. So, in doing so, Minjung thinkers avoid the traditional Christian concept of sin. They feel that sin is a term too charged with ideological meaning to be useful for the workers, peasants, women, and other oppressed people within the Minjung. What is considered a sin simply reflects the bias of the upper classes. According to Nam Dong-su, theories about sin are often nothing more than the labels the ruling class uses for the deprived. A good example is sex work, as you might have discussed if any of you are taking sex ethics. Which I know is a very popular class. One reason that sex work is dangerous is because sex workers are denied fundamental rights, such as the right to a safe working environment. But rather than recognize this denial of rights, which is inherent in the political system, the ruling class labels people who choose sex work to be sinners. So this is an example of how sinning is actually just a label, which is applied to the deprived. Given that sex workers are an important part of the Minjung and an important group with which Jesus himself associated and supported, Minjung theologians have developed Han as a way to address this relationship between the oppressive ruling class and the oppressed Minjung. There's a famous Bible story about how a sex worker washes Jesus' feet. This is a contemporary redepiction of that. So in the Minjung worldview, original sin does not come from the traditional story about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. In the traditional story, it is Adam and Eve's personal crime against God that results in all of humanity being sinners. But for Minjung thinkers, Han is most important. So they look elsewhere in the Old Testament. And they find the historical story of the Israelite nation. They see the long history of oppression by foreign powers over the Israelites, to be analogous to the history of Korea. They therefore see the story of Exodus, the story of the covenant between God and Israel, and other such stories, as the central focus of the Old Testament. These are models and inspirations for ways that God allows Han to be resolved in a productive way. What exactly is Han, first? I forgot about that. Han is primarily described as an emotion related to injustice. It can be described as just indignation or yearning for justice. It encompasses resentment, regret, anger, longing, sorrow. It is every emotion of the experience of oppression condensed into one emotion. Because Han replaces sin in the Minjung worldview, it is Han that reflects humanity's state of fallenness. So this is another justification for why salvation has to be addressing communal reality rather than individual reality. As long as there is oppression in the world, there will be Han, and as long as there is Han, there is no salvation. By ending oppression between communities, you end Han and enter the millennium, which we already discussed. Han builds up in the hearts of the oppressed as a compressed, repressed feeling. At some point, if there is too much Han, this feeling will explode, metaphorically. When this happens, it can mean violence, rage, and destruction being unleashed in society. But Han can also be turned towards the good. If it is properly handled, this powerful emotion can be used as the creative energy and the empathy needed for artistic expression or for social revolution. Minjung Christianity involves rituals that act to resolve this collective Han in a positive rather than destructive manner. Theologians talk about Dan, which is about cutting off the cycle of revenge. It is about cutting off Han by releasing it in a miraculous, transformative explosion of the will for justice and freedom. Sorry, I forgot this slide, so... So there's an important structural similarity to shamanism here. Shamans are normally called in to control people beset by evil spirits. They either drive out the evil spirits, inviting good spirits to take their place, or they can bind the evil spirits and thus change them into good spirits. Ritually, this process is similar to that of controlling Han. In fact, some Korean Christians in the 1980s found ways to incorporate shaman ritual more concretely into the church, going so far as to wear traditional shaman dress while they were preaching in church. Shamans and Christians would collaborate at street protests, and Minjung Christians would emphasize that shamanism is the indigenous Korean basis for Korean national spirit, and therefore should be the basis for Minjung Christianity. So they're very close. Shamans have this term called sinbyung, which means spirit sickness. It is the mental or physical illness that comes from being afflicted by an evil spirit. Women and men who suffer through a spirit affliction and manage to be healed are then capable of becoming shamans themselves. So this sickness ends up being a kind of gift to the shaman, assuming they get through it. There's a similar understanding here with the work with Han. Jesus himself experienced the Han of oppression, betrayal, torture, crucifixion by the state. By this experience, he shares in the Minjung's Han. And moreover, like the shaman who discovers her curative powers by overcoming sinbyung, Jesus' resurrection is now the power to cure others experiencing oppression. And we'll really see this when we talk about the Eucharist. I'll also just mention here the idea shared with Pure Land Buddhism that the very people rejected by society and called evil are the most suitable subjects for salvation. Of course, these are very different philosophies, as you should know already. But many Minjung thinkers nevertheless take inspiration from Pure Land Buddhism, not only because of its emphasis on the common people, but also because they are both movements that strive to realize utopian societies in this very world. So the last thing we'll talk about is the Eucharist. So the Eucharist has acquired new significance and meaning today in Korea. It is celebrated more frequently than in the past, and the character of the Eucharist as a meal is being emphasized. The Eucharist is the central ritual in traditional Catholic services, but the evangelical Protestants who came to Korea would have put more emphasis on the direct encounter with Jesus and the direct revelation through the Bible. While Catholics partake of communion as frequently as possible, Protestants often will take months between communion services. So the fact that the Eucharist has gained importance in Minjung Christianity suggests that this ritual is drawing on an indigenous source of inspiration rather than the inherited Protestant source. Traditionally, the Eucharist is seen as a ritual of atonement. It is an opportunity to remember God's sacrifice, which allows Christians to be saved. Practitioners ask forgiveness, and their salvation is reconfirmed through the ritual eating of bread and wine. It is solemn and individualistic. By contrast, the Eucharist in a Korean Pentecostal church is festive and triumphal, with strong communal aspects. To explain this innovation, some scholars point to the shaman gut, or kut, ceremony. I'm really sorry if anyone here speaks Korean. Confucian ancestor altars and other folk rituals also have this communal sharing of food as the central ritual. The Confucian ancestor altar, for instance, was traditionally a place in the family home where practitioners would provide food sacrifices to memorialize their ancestors. It is not a simple nostalgia for the family history. Through the ritual of offering life-giving food, the practitioners reinvigorate their connection to their progenitors, who they're giving life to, and for whom they owe everything. So this has a merely structural similarity to the Eucharist, but I thought I would bring it up. More compelling are the parallels with shaman and folk festivals. During festivals such as New Year's and Harvest Festival, the village's families in old Korea would gather together. They would share abundant food, including rice and rice cakes, and drink rice wine. There would be chatting and music and dance and festive rituals and games. And in the shaman gut ceremony, there is a religious service provided to individual families. The hosts provide abundant food offerings for the spirits and ancestors that are called into the gut hall. Offerings of food and wine are held up throughout the ceremony, reminiscent of the Eucharist. And as the ceremony is quite long, full meals are incorporated into it, including dinner or breakfast. Along with sacrificial rituals, participants sing songs, engage in dialogues and dramas, and make music. So scholars theorize that the goal of these festive food-centered ceremonies is community renewal. The village festivals are brief moments when people could leave their work behind and meet simply to socialize. There would be moments for reconciling differences with one's neighbors and family. The festivals required shared financial and organizational responsibility between many families as well. A successful festival would therefore renew and solidify community relations. In the shaman gut, we only have one family, but the role of the shaman is to express through songs and dialogue and sacrifice personal and collective histories of suffering. This forms the core of the exorcism, through which the family reconciles itself to its cursed fate and moves forward. Group solidarity is reinforced and revitalized. One scholar notes that this is similar to prayer, but rather than a personal act, the gut is a communal act. And rather than the prayer as the act itself, the gut uses food sacrifice as the act central to this ritual. So I'll just quickly relate this back to Minjung theology. is probably because of the Korea's roots in these sorts of ceremonies that the Christian Eucharist has become a festive, musical, triumphal celebration with the offering of bread and wine at its center. For Korean Christians, the weekly church service now serves as a place where they can escape work to reconnect with their community. In Minjung Christianity, there are some important differences, of course. Unlike the Shamangut, the Eucharist is a sacrifice offered up for all of humanity, not just the family or the clan. Christians see the Eucharist as a celebration of Jesus' overcoming death on the cross. So Minjung theologians would see it rather as a celebration of the capacity for oppressed peoples to overcome their oppression and to live freely in a revolutionized world. The reason this is important is because it... So this isn't just a symbolic act. Some thinkers actually describe the Eucharist as a moment of Pentecost, which is to say the moment when the Holy Spirit descends onto the practitioners. If we recall, the definition of Holy Spirit is that of love, the reciprocal movement of emptying between God and creation. We can then understand what the Eucharist is literally about. It is the moment when individuals are emptying themselves into a meeting with God, which means they are becoming equally empty. And they experience this as a community of equally empty people. So the community joined together for this ritual is actually actualizing the salvific community that they are trying to create, a community where there is no oppression, where there is no division between peoples. This is important because in most protests, as you can see, there is a strong division between people, between Koreans. So this helps to explain why Christians who are joining workers and students in the street to protest would use the rituals of the church, such as the special mass or the outdoor mass, as acts of protest. It helps explain why they can say that they are not being political, they are being religious. They're trying to actualize the religious community that they seek to build, and in so doing, it becomes political on the street. So thank you very much, and I'm very sorry.